When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture. Luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife, and this week we are going to have another mock oral scenario today, and one of the feedback we got from listeners is in some of their mock oral scenarios, they've been having some thoracic cases, and depending on the program you're at, there's more or less thoracic exposure. And so today we have Dr. Burfield, Chief of Thoracic Surgery at the Seattle VA, and Wu Do actually worked with her while he was on his thoracic rotation out there and asked her, and she was generous enough to spend part of her Sunday afternoon with us. So thank you, Dr. Burfield, for joining us on Behind the Knife.
Of course, happy to.
So before we begin, actually, there's a slight piece of lore that we wanted to confirm with you, Dr. Burfield. We've heard that when you were a thoracic surgery fellow at the University of Washington, you once completed a bilateral lung transplant with a co-fellow in 3 hours. Is that correct?
Oh, that is true. Were you talking to Dustin Walters?
We were.
Yes, that is definitely a highlight of our residency.
And just for our listeners out there, you are actually the first graduate of the cardiothoracic residency at University of Washington. Is that correct?
I am. So I'm the first in the integrated thoracic program at the UW. Yeah.
And how long is that at UW?
It is a six-year residency.
A six-year residency. And then they kept you on as staff afterwards.
Correct. Yes, I was fortunate enough to get to stay.
That's awesome. So, Dr. Burfield, let's dive right in. I'll be the first sacrificial lamb here.
All right, Will. Okay, so our first scenario is a 42-year-old woman who had a head trauma in a motor vehicle collision about a month ago. Ultimately ended up vent dependent and is now 3 weeks status post tracheostomy by the trauma service. And you are the resident on call, and you were called because of brisk bleeding coming out of her tracheostomy appliance.
So I would definitely have a high alarm for concern here. The leading item on my differential is a bleeding from a tracheostomic fistula, so massive hemoptysis. While I'm on the phone with the nurse that has called me, I would ask her if she can overinflate the cuff, and I would quickly make my way down to the patient and assess the vital signs as well as his ABCs.
All right. Excellent. So upon arrival at the bedside, you find that the hyperinflation of the cuff did work a little bit, so she's not totally exsanguinating. The patient, however, is tachycardic, currently normotensive. There's about 700 cc's of blood in the suction canister. Her oxygen saturation is 96% on a 50% FiO2. And what do you want to do now?
Okay, boy. So the patient does sound somewhat stabilized, but I'm also very concerned that this needs to go into the operating room. I would alert all of the means I have to get anesthesia, and all the help that I can get. I would alert my attending. My next move would actually be to place my finger through the stoma and direct it kind of downwards towards the xiphoid process and lift up anteriorly with my finger to try to compress what I presume is the location of this tracheotomy fistula. When I do that maneuver, do I get any more control of the bleeding?
Yes, you do.
Okay. So with my finger in that position, I would certainly be asking for help to make sure this patient is adequately lined up, that she has two large bore peripheral IVs at least. I would have massive transfusion protocol initiated, and I'd try to get our team mobilized down to the OR as soon as possible.
Okay, so you make it down to the OR.
Okay. At this point, with anesthesia and all the help around me, I'd want to try to get a more definitive airway access across this.
Okay.
Am I able to orotracheally intubate across the stoma?
Yeah, how would you do that?
I would have anesthesia from above try to do it orotracheally.
Okay. So they're able to advance the, or get the airway or the endotracheal tube into the trachea, but your finger and the tracheostomy appliance are still in there. So I assume you're going to take it out?
So I'm going to start by taking out the tracheostomy, but leaving my finger in there.
So bleeding is better controlled. And where are you going to place the tip of your endotracheal tube, or ask anesthesia to put their tip of their endotracheal tube?
I think I would try to go just about 2 centimeters proximal to the carina.
All right, sounds good. All right, so with the endotracheal tube in place and your finger in there so far, bleeding seems controlled. They have all the access they want. The nurses have astutely prepped and draped the patient. And what is your plan in terms of proceeding with repair of or evaluation of what you think is a tracheal innominate fistula?
So at this point, with my finger prepped in, what I want my team to help me do is make an incision directly overlying my finger and just carefully go down until we encounter the fistula and just try to ligate that fistula.
Okay, what incision are you, are you just making a skin incision, or are you, what kind of incision are you making? Like, what is your plan in order to be able to get access to the innominate artery?
Gotcha. I have a high suspicion that this is not going to be controlled with just a skin incision and that it's actually going to need to go down through a median sternotomy.
All right, perfect. So describe your sternotomy to me and then kind of what you're thinking and looking for.
Okay. As I go down through the skin and soft tissue, I'm just going to try to create enough of a space above the level of the superior most portion of the sternum so that I could get a saw and take the saw from cephalad to caudad, and once I go through and I put in the retractors, I should be able to be looking directly upon the innominate, and I hope that once I'm there, the anatomy, once I clear the anatomy around, will be a little bit more clear to me where the fistula is.
Okay. So you've done your sternotomy then, you've divided thymus and pre-pericardial tissue, fat. Your innominate vein has been retracted superiorly so that you can see your innominate artery. And then how are you going to obtain, then what are you going to do?
Then just general principles, I'd want to try to get get maybe like a POTS tie around proximally and distally so that once I let go of where my finger is, that if I pull up, I can kind of occlude that bleeding, get proximal distal control, and then just identify the fistula and ligate that fistula.
Okay. So that bottom, the underside of the artery is pretty adherent and kind of stuck to trachea.
At that point, I would certainly hope that there was some additional help to help me figure out what to do next.
Okay. So additional help arrives and helps you dissect the artery free from the trachea. And then how are you going to ligate your artery? What are you going to do?
So I would take a silk suture or another permanent suture and pass it through the center and then kind of wrap it around in one direction and then in a counter direction as well in order to get a good ligation around 360 degrees.
Okay. And then what are you going to do with the trachea?
So at that point, the stoma is still there. I think that it'd be nice to get some sort of healthy tissue. I'm trying to think what I could use some tissue around there to buttress or to even just interpose so that the likelihood of another fistula developing is decreased, but I'm struggling to come up with that right now.
Okay. How would you close your trachea? Like, how would you close your defect?
So I would try to close the defect in an interrupted fashion and then try to buttress that repair.
Great. So you're going to use 3 ovicral sutures to repair your tracheal defect. And then since this patient fortunately had some nice thymus tissue there, you're going to use that thymus to kind of buttress your repair then. All righty. How are you going to manage this patient postoperatively?
So postoperatively, I'm going to continue airway management with the ET tube that was placed intraoperatively. I'm going to, ideally there would be, I think, a drain that was left before we left the operating room that would kind of serve as an early detection system. And I think I would wait at least 7 to 10 days before I do any sort of manipulation. But at some point, I'm going to want to do a bronchoscopy to evaluate the integrity of the repair.
Okay. So now what happens? So alternative scenario. So what happens when you get in there and you see that she has a bovine arch?
I have to admit that I'm not sure.
Okay. So essentially, you could do the same thing. You get distal proximate control of the carotid as well.
Okay.
Next scenario. So this is a 54-year-old woman who has rheumatoid arthritis, and she is on Remicade. And she presents to the emergency room with 2 weeks of cough, progressive shortness of breath, and pleuritic chest pain. The ER doc got a chest x-ray, and she has a moderate effusion and some consolidation in her right lower lobe. And they called you to help manage this patient.
It sounds like an immunocompromised patient with risk factors for infection has a right lower lobe consolidation and an associated effusion. Okay, so I would go down to the ER, and as I'm going into the patient's room, I'd want to quickly ascertain how sick this patient appears. I'd look at vitals, assess her ABCs, ensure she has adequate IV access, and has resuscitation ongoing.
Okay. She's on a liter of oxygen. Vital signs are stable. She's afebrile. White count is 18.
Okay. At this point, I do a focused history. And apart from what you had mentioned about her being on Remicade and having rheumatoid arthritis, does she have any other past medical history that's pertinent, or can she tell me anything more about associated symptoms or anything other than the duration of this being 2 weeks?
Yeah, so she doesn't have any other significant medical history. She's not had any intrathoracic surgeries or otherwise. And really, she said she started feeling poorly a couple weeks ago, got a cold from her granddaughter, and has been coughing since. And finally got to the point where she was having some shortness of breath and pain that she felt like she should go into the ER.
Okay. So at this point, I'd moved to a focused physical exam, specifically looking for a cardiopulmonary exam, and then, you know, checking for any sort of epigastric tenderness that she might have that's misconstrued as thoracic chest pain.
Okay. So left lung sounds fine, heart sounds fine. She's got some decreased breath sounds on the right. She's maybe a little focally tender if you palpate her right side, but no epigastric pain.
Okay. So at this point, I understand she's already had some imaging and some labs. You mentioned the white count and the chest x-ray.
Yep.
I'd want to next do a non-contrast CT of the chest.
Okay. So the CT chest shows that she's got a intraparenchymal infiltrate in the right lower lobe. Her lung isn't completely expanded because she has a moderate sized effusion.
Okay. So at this point, my leading differential is a paraneumonic effusion, probably an empyema.
Mm-hmm.
With what I know about the time course of these effusions, she's about 2 weeks out, and so would be probably beyond the initial exudative phase, going on into maybe the organizing phase, or just before then.
Mm-hmm.
So given that, I think that maybe a chest tube could potentially work, and it would give us a trial, I think, before we commit someone who is immunocompromised on to surgery. But that said, I would consider VATS early. So I've discussed those options with her, but I think I would recommend starting with a chest tube.
Okay. What kind of chest tube are you going to place?
I would place a chest tube that was large enough to drain out what I suspect is pus, and that would facilitate me putting intrapleural TPA and Dornase at some point. So I think I'd do at least a 28 French, probably about a 28 French.
Okay. So you put a 28 French chest tube in her right side and end up getting fluid that's kind of purulent appearing. What do you want to do then?
So first, having gotten that fluid out, I want to send the pleural fluid for studies. Specifically, I'd want to test for Gram stain culture that's aerobic, anaerobic, as well as fungal and acid fast to check for TB. And then after I send those studies, I'd start her on antibiotics. And then I'd admit her and just kind of observe how she, over the course of the next couple hours or so, how she responds to this. And then I think in the next morning, I would repeat a chest x-ray to see, or at least a couple hours later, I'd repeat a chest x-ray to see if there's any degree of improvement in the lung expansion.
Okay. So Gram stain is 4+ GPCs. Fungal culture isn't back yet. Acid fast isn't back yet. You started her on some ceftriaxone. Her chest tube drained about 100 cc's of fluid. And her follow-up chest x-ray is largely unchanged.
Okay. So given that the findings are unchanged, I think I would try a short course of intrapleural TPA and Dornase. I suspect there are loculations that are preventing the lung from completely re-expanding. And so I would try about 12 hours apart a couple iterations of TPA and Dornase intrapleurally.
Okay. So when you put the TPA and Dornase in, she has significant pain. with the installation, and you only get about 100 cc's out of kind of bloody, serosanguinous, purulent-looking fluid.
Okay. So at this point, I think the pain that I've seen associated with this can be quite dramatic, and so I would not necessarily be too alarmed with that, but I would want to help control her pain. I think I would continue with this for about another 24 hours and then repeat a CT non-con to see if there's any degree of improvement before committing her to a next step.
Okay. So you continued and you got 50 cc's out, which is about the volume of the TPA and Dornase that you put in. And her CT scan shows that her lung is still trapped and she still has a loculated effusion.
Okay. So at this point, I'd approach the patient and discuss with her that my leading suspicion is that the lung continues to be entrapped due to loculations and organization that is not being broken up adequately, that this was a good trial at a non-operative approach, but I do think that she's going to benefit from an operative attempt to fully re-expand her lung. So I would consent her for a, I believe this is right side, so a right-sided VAT, maybe possible decortication and possible pleuridesis.
Okay. So you get her to the OR. What are you going to do?
So I would have anesthesia, attempt to place a double lumen endotracheal tube. If she's able to tolerate, I would attempt single lung ventilation. I'd place her left lateral decubitus, the right side up. I would start with a VATS approach, place the trocar for the camera in about the fifth intercostal space, about anterior, in between the anterior and mid-axillary line. And I would try to enter once we have the lung down on that side. That may not be an issue because the lung's already kind of entrapped, but still, I would make a good effort at that. Then under direct visualization, I'd place them two additional ports, most likely ranging between the fourth and seventh intercostal space, but kind of triangulating up towards the apex. And I would take a good look and see which areas look organized, where the loculations are. I would attempt to fully drain everything and then break apart these major loculations.
Okay. So you stick your camera in and you see just a lot of fibrinous material all over the lung. She still has a pretty decent sized retained diffusion. And even after placing your second and third ports, you're unable to really effectively get this rind, this peel off.
And she's tolerating the operation okay thus far?
Yep, she's fine.
Okay. So if that's the case, I think that there actually is probably going to be no benefit to this approach as it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would do is I would convert to a thoracotomy. I would try to peel off as much of the rind as I can and then apply some sealant and do some pleuridesis to see if I can get the lung to skip the stick up.
Okay. All right. Now, where are you going to put your chest tube? So say there you're able to get her decorted. You placed your sealant, although where are you placing your sealant?
I would kind of see where, because invariably, I think as I take down and do the decortication, there are going to be areas that bubble up with air leaks, and I think I'd target those with the sealant.
Okay. And then where are you going to put your chest tubes?
I would place one posteriorly and directed apically. And then I'd place like a flexible Blake tube directed posteriorly and into the diaphragmatic sulcus.
All right. And then what?
And then we take her back to the ICU, or before I leave, I'd want to do intercostal, inject some local intercostally to do a nerve block. Then I'd take her out to the ICU for her recovery. And then I'd kind of watch and see how she does in terms of her pulmonary status.
Okay. Did you extubate her, or did you leave her intubated?
I would attempt a trial of extubation.
Okay. All right. So she was successfully extubated in the OR. Went up to the ICU, did fine, and discharged from the hospital happily. And thank you for saving her life. All righty. So review, yeah?
Yeah, thank you. That was challenging.
You did well. I'm glad that you got to spend some time with us at the U, since I'm sure you got to see some decords up there.
We did.
Yeah. All right. So, how do you think it went? Looking at going over your first scenario, anything you think that you would have mentioned in retrospect earlier or done differently?
I think the first scenario especially raised my sphincter tone a little bit. it's definitely a frightening scenario that I luckily haven't had to deal with yet. I think the challenging thing for me is visualizing what I do in the operating room, particularly because this isn't something that I've ever seen done before.
Yeah.
So I definitely appreciate your feedback on what your approach might be to actually try to ligate this fistula, or if even the approach that I took was the appropriate approach.
Okay. So I think that you did the right things in terms of telling initially when you got the call of having a kind of first step at just overinflating the cuff to see if that would tampen on the bleeding. And it kind of worked. And then you were able to get control of the bleeding a little bit better by inserting your finger into the stoma, which is the next step, and then applying some kind of anterior pressure against the sternum, which is correct. Luckily, in this scenario, it bought you some time to get down to the OR. And then really the key, right, is trying to get or establish your airway, because you know you're going to have to take your tracheostomy appliance out in order to kind of reevaluate and see what's actually going on.
Right.
And so intubating from above is great. And having your anesthesia team going to help you with that. Alternatively, if they're unsuccessful or if there's too much blood, then trying to do a rigid bronchoscopy and using that to maintain your airway initially is always something that's available to you as well. And then when it comes down to doing your sternotomy, really, if your fingers, so sometimes when you get your oral endotracheal tube in, simply blowing up that cuff can, in the right place, can give you some control, and you can always see if then you can potentially take your finger out, because the idea of having to do a sternotomy with the saw with your finger right there is a little dicey, but it happens.
Yeah.
So you can try to, you know, stick a Raytech or a lap in the in the stoma essentially to see if that will kind of buy you a little bit of time while you get your saw at least in place. I think otherwise, you know, getting your retractor in. So the first thing you do see, right, is all that thymic and pericardial fat and your innominate skin. And so and at this point you may or may not have your finger in the wound again in order to hold pressure on your innominate, but you had the right idea about, you know, finding and locating your innominate vein. That generally needs to be retracted towards the head in order to give you some good visualization, because the innominate artery and the arch, right, is going to sit right under there.
Right.
And so just clearing off this, working to clear off those tissues and I think you have the right idea about getting proximal and distal control, getting that looped out so that you can at least identify where your hole is. And then the key is, you know, resecting that little area of where your fistula is off of your innominate artery, and then over-sewing your over sewing the ends of your stump. I think usually like
I think that part I had trouble visualizing how that would take place.
Yeah. And so, you know, a lot of times, depending on how friable the tissue is, you can get a right angle, or, you know, you can get a right angle around it and at the very tip, and then, you know, like a stick tie and I think a two-layer closure just to over-sew the ends. And then I think the hard part was, you know, what to do with this big tracheal defect for you. And so, closing your trachea, and we usually will use absorbable sutures for closing the tracheal defect. And then it is hard to find a good muscle flap. Sometimes, you know, if you have really, really prominent mesenteric fat and thymus will work. It's harder to find a big flap like strap muscles because they don't really reach down there. So generally trying to find a thymus there is useful. So not resecting all that. And then the key is like keeping that endotracheal tube in. Sometimes at the end you'll have to bronch just to clean out airways, and so keep that in mind as well.
Okay.
Since they've been bleeding into their airway the whole time. Otherwise, I think you handled that scenario nicely.
Just to be clear, so you completely ligate the innominate artery.
Correct.
In this scenario. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, essentially, right? It's similar to if you're covering your, like doing a T-bar and you're covering your subclavian. Usually you don't get steel or have ischemia in your arm. And presumably this person is otherwise young and should have good a good circle of Willis and should be able to be fine with the flow from her left carotid, assuming that she doesn't have a bovine arch. So,
yeah. With the bovine arch, do you need to divide the carotid and reimplant it or anything?
No, so it kind of depends on where it is. Usually that the origin of your carotid is the closer to the arch, and so you should, there's quite frequently you'll be able to get around the kind of ongoing anomaly to your common carotid without having to sacrifice your carotid artery.
Okay.
I can show you a picture later.
Great.
All right. And so for your second scenario, the empyema, I think that you, in terms of leaving C-strings went well, you know, it's kind of obvious if we're talking about a consolidation on the right side and she has an effusion and she has a white count, we're probably going down the road of your paraneumonic effusion or an empyema. So you had your differential there, which is great. I think that starting out and getting a CT scan of a CT chest. So depending on creatinine plus minus on using contrast as well, it'll give you more rim enhancement. Kind of give you a better sense of the rind if you're able to get contrast. It's not absolutely necessary, but it gives you a little bit more information about the rind and the kind of septations and loculations and things. You place a chest tube, which is fine. I think that you'll never be faulted for putting in a larger bore chest tube. Send all of the right studies. I would refer folks to the AATS consensus guidelines because they have a nice set of guidelines on the management of empyema. And usually it starts with an ultrasound guided thoracentesis to check your fluids, plus minus chest tube placement initially.
Like
you talked about, at some point you did the right thing in terms of repeating your x-ray to make sure that you had either resolution of your effusion and re-expansion of your lung, kind of seeing what things looked like. Right now, you know, the use of TPA and Dornase or fibrinolytics is controversial, but generally not a first-line thing that you do unless there are extenuating circumstances and the patient is unstable or not a candidate to go to the operating room for whatever reason. So I'd say for board purposes, you're a surgeon and surgeons operate. And so
early VATS preferred.
Yeah. Sometimes I don't know that you necessarily need to mention it. You know, a lot of times the anesthesiologist, as long as there's no fever, are okay putting epidurals in for pain control. But otherwise, you know, you had the right idea in terms of planning for a VATS. I think you got just a little turned around because you said VATS possible decortication. We know we're going to do a decort, so it's you know, the right VATS possible thoracotomy for decortication.
That's right.
And so making sure that you have the thoracotomy on there. I will usually also include a bronchoscopy on my consents because quite frequently at the end, either before or after, in order to make sure that you can get really good lung re-expansion, you might feel obligated to go in and clean out the airways on that right lower lobe just to see since she hasn't had a bronch before and just to make sure that there isn't anything in there that you can clean out to help her get re-expansion. Otherwise, I think starting VATS is fine. You know, whether depending on the CT scan, whether you put your, if you have a chest tube in, frequently you can place your scope through the same hole, or you could make a separate incision and kind of some of that's based on your CT scan. Some people would prefer to go kind of where you went, which is in the like fifth intercostal space in the anterior axillary line in order to stick a camera in. I'd look around first because a lot of times once you look in, you stick a grasper in and start trying to peel things off. You can get a better sense of whether or not you're going to be successful staying VATS or if you're going to need to convert before you put a bunch of other ports in, just style points. So as long as everyone's clear, you know, it's like stating your goals at some point. You know, the goal of the decortication is to remove all of the infectious tissue and then also to affect lung re-expansion. And so, you know, making sure that you clear off your the lower lobe along the diaphragm, posterior, anteriorly, and make sure that your fissures are nice and clear. And then wide drainage. Usually you don't need to put sealants in. Sometimes you will, like you've mentioned, make little rents in the parenchyma. But usually just there's so much blood in there anyways, and they're easy inflammation. So you generally don't need to actually put sealants in unless it's a really large gash. So I don't think you need to mention that. But otherwise the other key is trying to get them extubated as soon as possible because that positive pressure of staying intubated will certainly prevent their lung from being fully expanded, and it'll mitigate or continue to allow those small air leaks that make it harder to ventilate and things. So trying to get them extubated as soon as possible is important.
Great. That's fantastic feedback, ma'am. Thank you so much.
Of course. Kevin, you now?
Yep, here I am. So now this will be a good comparison to see the resident that got the UW rotation versus the one that did not rotate on thoracic. So here we go.
All right. I'm sure it'll be just fine. Okay. So you are a 50-year-old, or sorry, you are fine. You're not 50. You have a 50-year-old man who has intractable nausea and vomiting. He's an alcoholic. And he has excruciating pain, chest pain, and came into the ER. And you are the person on call in the ER and have been called to see him.
Okay. Intractable chest pain after vomiting, it can be a concern for the worst-case scenario, which would be an esophageal perf. So I'm going to go see the patient, assess his ABCs. But it sounds like he's stable at this point in time.
He's tachycardic, heart rate's 110, but his blood pressure is fine.
Okay, so I'd get bilateral, large bore IVs, send labs off on him, and then I perform a focused physical exam looking for crepitus and listening for lung sounds and doing an abdominal exam.
Okay, so on physical exam, he's tachycardic, a little diaphoretic, but otherwise has decreased breath sounds on the left side, and his abdomen is a little tender.
Okay. I would perform a chest x-ray while I'm in the ER as I'm calling radiology to get set up for my my esophagram.
Okay, so he has a small left-sided effusion.
Okay. So I would call radiology and tell them I want to start with gastrographin, upper GI to evaluate for a possible esophageal leak. And I'd like to get some more history on this patient too. Does he have any other pertinent medical history or medications that he's on?
He does not. He's a smoker. He's not on any medications, doesn't really see doctors, and hasn't had any surgeries.
And I'm sorry, did you say he is an alcoholic? I can't remember.
He is.
He is an alcoholic. Okay. And so, yeah, I'd go perform the gastrographin swallow, and if it's unrevealing, I would proceed with a thin barium swallow.
Perfect. So the swallow shows that he has extrav of contrast into his left chest. But some of the contrast goes distally into the stomach.
Okay. So I would start him on broad-spectrum antibiotics and fluid resuscitate him and cross and type him for 2 units. I would call the operating room and get him set up for a left thoracotomy in order to repair his esophageal, his ruptured esophagus.
Okay. So what would you consent him for?
I would consent him for a left thoracotomy with esophageal repair, possible esophagectomy, and I would also consent him for an EGD.
Alrighty, so you perform your EGD and see that he has a perforation in his distal esophagus just above the GEJ.
Okay, just above the GEJ. And I'd also had on that consent a feeding tube, but he's asleep now. I guess it's too late. I'll call his wife.
Okay.
So, I'm sorry, you said I did the EGD and there's a perf... just at the lower part of the esophagus?
Distal esophagus doesn't involve the GEJ. There's no evidence of malignancy or strictures.
Okay. So it sounds like he has kind of the classic Boerhaave's. So I place the patient in the right lateral decubitus and perform a single lung ventilation. It's not necessary, but if anesthesia is able to provide it and he tolerates it well, it could help exposure. And I would, as I'm making my thoracotomy in the 7th intercostal space, I would plan for a intercostal flap as I'm making my incision. And then I would evacuate out the purulence out of his chest and irrigate copiously at the beginning of the case, and then attempt to identify my anatomy. Generally, I would open up the, a lot of times the muscle defect is a lot smaller than what's in the mucosa, so I would make a myotomy longitudinally in order to identify my mucosal defect. Once I identified my mucosal defect, I would close it with a like a 3-0 running stitch, and then do interrupted silks for my my second layer of muscle, and then place a intercostal muscle flap to buttress this repair. I would place 2 chest tubes in the chest to help adequately drain the mediastinum, 1 apically and 1 along the diaphragm. And at the conclusion of my case, I would likely place a jejunostomy tube. And I'm sorry, and when I perform that repair, I would perform it over a 48 French bougie in order to not to help hopefully prevent a stricture. And then I would laparoscopically place a jejunostomy tube at the conclusion of the case for feeding access, as he's going to be in PO for a prolonged period of time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll go back for a second. So you actually arrive in the OR and he is unstable. Blood pressure is in the toilet, anesthesia starting pressors, And when you start looking at the esophagus, the tissue is just falling apart and there's no healthy tissue. What would you do then?
Okay. At this point, I would widely drain his chest. I would irrigate. And, you know, if he's tanking that badly and I don't have time to do a spit fistula, I think irrigation and widely draining will, and making him MPO with IV antibiotics will hopefully get him to a point where we could take him back to the OR and perform an esophageal diversion. If at that time I'm able to perform an esophageal diversion, I would with a kind of a cervical esophago fistula. Would be my plan. Those would be my two options. So right now, if he's that unstable, I would just irrigate out, widely drain, and get him on broad spectrum antibiotics.
Okay. Are there any other options?
I think I could have kind of divided the devitalized esophagus and performed like a gastrostomy and a cervical fistula.
Okay. Alrighty. You mobilize the esophagus in your, and how are you going to form your esophagostomy?
I would make a left neck incision, carefully mobilize the esophagus and proximally and distally in order to give me some length. I would divide the esophagus, and then generally what I've seen is just near the clavicle, you bring out the distal aspect of the cervical esophagus for drainage.
Okay. And would you plan on reconstructing him later at all?
Yes. If that were the case, I could potentially use his stomach is still okay, that I could potentially perform a gastric conduit reconstruction.
Okay, great. Next scenario. You have a 63-year-old woman who is a former 30-pack-year smoker, no other medical history, and she was found to have a 10-millimeter peripheral right upper lobe nodule seen on chest x-ray, which was part of a preoperative workup for a knee replacement. How would you proceed with management of this patient?
Okay. So you've told me already that she has a pack year history. Does she have any previous history of lung cancer or any other cancers?
She does not.
Any other significant comorbidities?
No, she has a little bit of hypertension, is on lisinopril, but otherwise no other medications and no prior surgeries.
Okay. It's a pretty small nodule, but giving her smoking history, I'm concerned. So I would go ahead and get a CT scan of the chest with in combination with a PET scan in order to help further define this lesion.
Okay, so the CT scan shows that you have a 10-millimeter peripheral nodule in the right upper lobe, smooth borders, close to the pleura, not calcified. She doesn't have any significant mediastinal adenopathy. She has mild emphysema, upper lobe predominant. And her PET CT scan shows that she has an SUV of 3.5 in this nodule, but no other SUV uptake.
Okay. Given her smoking history, and given the concerning findings, I would, give her two options of, watching and closely, waiting and closely watching versus a wedge resection of this lesion. Given her smoking history and SUV uptake by the PET scan, I would counsel her that I'd recommend the a wedge resection of this after she had a completion pulmonary function test and cardiac evaluation to make sure she qualifies for surgery.
Okay. And what would you do? So she says, okay, I'll have a wedge resection. So what are you going to consent her for? And what's your procedure?
So I'm going to consent her for a wedge resection of this lesion, possible right upper lobectomy if we're unable to identify it, and possible possible thoracotomy.
Okay. What would you do with the? Would you do anything with her stage four mediastinum at all?
I think this is controversial, but given that it's a small lesion and that there was no adenopathy seen on PET CT, I think it's reasonable to not do any further preoperative staging.
Okay. So you take her to the operating room and you do your wedge resection. And she's extubated postoperatively on day one. In the operating room. And then on day one, she becomes increasingly hypoxic. What do you do?
Okay. She's hypoxic. So is her chest tube, I would get a chest x-ray, and are her chest tubes to suction, or what are the status of her chest tube at this point?
So her chest tubes were left to suction, yeah.
Left to suction. And what does my chest x-ray show?
So your chest x-ray looks like she has increasing bilateral fluffy infiltrates.
Okay. So I would send off labs, and I would send off a cardiac panel, specifically troponins. I would get a stat echo on the patient. I'm concerned that she is going into heart failure, and I would kind of put her on, you know, high flow oxygen in the meantime, and be suspicious that she may need to be intubated if she doesn't improve quickly here.
Okay, so she's on 100% high flow. She's saturations are in the 80s. She's really working to breathe.
Yeah, at this point, I would ask anesthesia to intubate her to protect her airway and to improve her because she's in respiratory failure at this point.
Okay. And how would you manage her vent setting?
Is she in heart failure? Did her troponins come back okay?
Troponins are not elevated. No EKG changes.
No EKG changes, yeah. That's important. Okay. So she's having bilateral pulmonary edema. I would probably put her on a little increased PEEP to help expand her lungs, but otherwise conventional with just possible site elevation in the PEEP. Consider diuresis to help improve this pulmonary edema.
Okay. Alternatively, so she's extubated in the OR, and then you notice, though, that she has a fairly significant air leak in her chest, from her chest tube.
Okay. So I would... And this is like day one, like post-op day one, that I see the significant chest, the air leak?
Yep.
Okay. I would give it 48 hours, and if there's no improvement, I would attempt a blood patch.
Okay. She still has an air leak.
Still has an air leak. Okay. After that, I would attempt through the chest tube, I would attempt, first of all, one thing I would be doing is decreasing my suction in order on the chest tube, so hopefully not keeping this kind of air leak open with high the suction. And then I would attempt a talc kind of pleuresis through the chest tube to see if I can get it to seal up.
So decreasing suction didn't work. She developed a pneumothorax, some increased shortness of breath, and a little bit of chest pain. And the talc through the chest tube goes in, and yet there's no real changes on her CT scan, or sorry, her chest x-ray. She still has a pneumothorax, and she still has an air leak.
Okay. At this point, essentially have like a bronchopleural fistula, and she doesn't tolerate coming off of suction at all. So I think I would take her back to the operating room in order to attempt to operatively fix this air leak.
Okay. So what are you going to do?
I would go back in the same vat. I would, in my same ports that I use for the wedge, I would put her lung under, you know, water and have them insufflate and try and identify the air leak. Am I able to identify it?
Yeah. So you have a substantial air leak from your staple line.
From my staple line. Okay. From here, I would probably make a kind of a mini thoracotomy in an area where I could bring the lung parenchyma out. I would over-sew this area with an absorbable suture, and I would place a sealant over top of it. And then I would complete the surgery and put her to kind of put her to suction overnight and see how she does.
Okay, so after you suture the staple line and put the sealant on, her air leak improves, and next day her air leak is, she has a small air leak with Valsalva, but otherwise all but resolved.
Okay, I would take her off of suction at this point in time and then see how she's closely monitored.
Great. So you take her off suction, she does fine, you're able to get the chest tube out, and she's able to go home. Her pathology shows that she has a 1 centimeter adenocarcinoma in her wedge of suction with margins that are widely negative. What sort of follow-up does she need, if any?
She needs close follow-up with a repeat chest CT within 6 months. I would have her, I don't think there's any role for adjuvant therapy, but I would have her evaluated by oncology just to have the discussion. Yeah, for the first year, I would do a CT scan at 6 months and then at 1 year, and I'd see her in my clinic at those times for that.
Okay, great. All righty, so how do you think you did?
I'm sweating a little bit. They were tough, but they're very fair scenarios. So thank you.
Yeah, of course. You guys both did fine. You did well. I think it's very brave of you to do this and then podcast it to everybody. I don't know that I would have felt that confident if I were in your position late in residency. So.
It's funny. We have a really hard time finding volunteers to help. So
I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised you can't find people to be on the receiving side of these questions.
Everyone seems to be on call Sunday afternoon. So
yeah, I'm sure. All those emergency surgeries happening in the hospital.
Exactly.
How do you think the esophageal perforation went? Anything that you feel like would add in there sooner or later or change around?
Yeah, I think the kind of standard esophageal perf that I read about went okay, but I don't think I was prepared enough for the scenario where, you know, I can't repair it in the traditional fashion. And, you know, so I don't really know what the exact right steps were in that aspect of it.
Okay. So I think that you did everything in order like you should have. So you did an appropriate assessment. You knew to get the esophagram, knew about gastrographin versus thin barium. So even if it's negative by gastrographin, you'd still do the thin barium. I think that you caught yourself, and I think in terms of doing, adding on the EGD, potentially putting the PEG, like a feeding tube in or a PEG tube in or something at the time of surgery. But otherwise, we're able to explain the procedure in terms of positioning, you know, single lung ventilation if the patient tolerated it, but knowing that it wasn't absolutely necessary. Site of your incision in the seventh intercostal space, taking a muscle flap, I think, is important in the beginning, which is some people miss, and I think that's very useful, so that you have something to buttress your repair with. And then making sure that you identify the mucosal defect fully. I think that, you know, closing your, everybody closes and repairs differently. And so knowing that you're going to use an absorbable suture, then silk to close your, the esophageal muscle is perfect. And then, let's see, I think that if, when you got to the point where the patient was unstable, I think that you did a good job of kind of recognizing that it wasn't a position where you were going to be able to repair successfully just because the patient wasn't tolerating it, kind of focusing on just mobilization of the esophagus so that you can set yourself up for a diverting esophagostomy, and then making sure that you had some means of drainage in the stomach. So peg tube or G-tube, open G-tube, either way, in the stomach. And a feeding tube option so that you could set yourself up for success in the future. But otherwise, I don't think that you'll be, I wouldn't expect you to be able to fully explain the intricacies of forming your diverting esophagostomy, aside from the fact that you would, you know, try to get as much length on your esophagus as possible. And then when you pull it out into your neck, you know, transecting esophagus above your perforation, and then making sure that you've got good drainage of your stomach and the conduit below, and then making sure you've got good drainage, which I think you did. In terms of the salutary pulmonary nodule, you were able to recognize that the patient had a was high risk based on smoking history as well as age. I think that you, depending on where it could have gone, getting your CT scan is probably the first thing. So CT scan followed by PET CT scan is totally appropriate. You can go into kind of varying amounts of discussion about Fleischner guidelines regarding, you know, size of nodules, which actually are changed this year, essentially, in terms of now focusing more on, you know, whether or not the nodules are, you know, greater than less than 6 to 8 millimeters, but essentially, you know, you had the correct follow-up for the nodules and the counseling about, you know, watching, waiting versus resection. I think that consenting her for the wedge and a possible lobectomy is appropriate. So generally when you're in the OR, you'll send frozen in order to get your diagnosis. And then that's kind of a conversation of, you know, do you do the completion lobectomy if you're in there and you know that it's cancer versus counseling the patient about, you know, I think gold standard previously for patients who could otherwise tolerate it was lobectomy for all lung cancers. And now there's been a move, which I don't know that is particularly pertinent for the general surgery boards, but a move towards sublobar resection being acceptable for patients who, where it's otherwise their preference or their high risk. Making sure you got your PFTs, so making sure you have your PFTs beforehand is appropriate. The air leak management, so I think that in terms of vent management for the ARDS, it's mostly just recognizing that this patient has had some event for whatever reason, and she's going into ARDS, and so LASIK and PEEP basically just like ARDSnet sort of information and management. And then for the air leak, I think, you know, waiting, everyone will wait a different amount of time. It depends on how brisk the leak is and what happens with as you decrease suction. So decreasing suction was great. I would not have done a talc pleuritesis or put talc in the chest tube before re-exploring the patient because of the ramifications of talc in your chest space, in your pleural space, just creating a large inflammatory reaction and just making, if you needed to go back. In this case, it was a pretty simple fix. It was your staple line, and so you could either re-resect it or you could try to, buttress it with either sutures, or you could have just done a potentially another wedge resection to clean up your staple line if needed, and that would be made a little bit more difficult with talc in there already. So probably wouldn't have talc before before just re-exploring the patient. And then follow up for lung cancers is guidelines are a CT scan every 6 months for the first 2 years, and then annually thereafter. To make sure that there's no evidence of either recurrence or new lung cancer development.
Would you send them to see an oncologist ever in a small negative case like
for that? So we don't know that she's node negative, right? We didn't check. Generally, for the patients that have the likelihood that a patient with T1A, so a small, like a very early stage lung cancer, having positive nodes is low, but I generally would not. If I know that it's a T1A, I generally will follow them myself.
Okay, great.
They're not wrong to offer evaluation with oncology, though.
Okay. Well, I learned a ton, and we really thank you for taking your time out to help educate us in thoracic surgery.
Yeah, Dr. Brookfield, that was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for thinking of me, Wu.
All right, guys
did great.
Have a great one.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right,
bye.
Until next time, dominate the day.